From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. Welcome to another episode of UBC Arts on Air. Today, Mandy Len Catron, a member of the English department at UBC and the author of a widely read recent column in the New York Times on making yourself fall in love. Mandy, welcome.
Thanks, Ira. It's really fun to be here.
Okay, let's come right out with it. Can someone make themselves fall in love with another? I mean, this is the question everybody is asking.
This is the question I've been asked many times, and, you know, my answer, I think, is a little disappointing, which is maybe. I think there's a lot that has to fall in place, but I also think, you know, the way that we normally talk about love is this thing that really happens to us and that we have to be really passive about and just sort of patiently wait for, when, you know, I also think we can have a lot of agency in that process. So, you know, I think to be compatible with another person requires a lot of different things, you know, physical attraction, a sort of similar level of interest in different, like, lifestyle activities, you know, all of that stuff, I think, goes a long way. But I also think it requires things that you can control, like trust, intimacy, vulnerability, and those are things that I think we have a lot of agency over. And so that's where the maybe comes from.
Okay. What about something like age? How important is that?
Age. Interesting.
Have you considered age, or how do you see age as a factor?
That's a good question. I think compatibility can happen in a lot of different ways. And there's a big difference in falling in love with someone and having a committed relationship with someone. So, you know, I think I'd probably say when it comes to falling in love, which is a relatively straightforward neurochemical process, you could say, none of that stuff matters all that much. But I would say, in terms of investing in someone and committing to someone and having a long relationship with someone, a lot of those dynamics might matter more, right? So, like, I think the thing with age is that it creates, or potentially could create, a power imbalance or a dynamic where one person has more life experience and the other person has less. And, you know, in many ways, those things could matter for investing in someone for the long term. But I don't know. Like, Helen Fisher is a biological anthropologist who writes about, one of the things she's written that I think is really interesting is that she doesn't perceive a difference in intense early stage romantic love and love at first sight. Like, she thinks those two things are basically the same. For whatever reason, I don't know why this happens, men experience love at first sight a lot more often than women. But she would say, you know, from a, like, if you put someone who said, I've fallen in love at first sight, that, like, instant attraction, and someone who said, I'm in intense love in an early relationship, if you put both of them into fMRI brain scans, their brains would look the same. So she says, you know, that this, like, lust or love at first sight in actual romantic love are maybe not very different, which I think is really interesting. So then, you know, if you want to say, does age matter? If you think about it that way, like, not really.
No, it shouldn't.
Maybe not.
Really. But
yeah,
you're making some nice distinctions here between attraction, love, and commitment. Now, do I have to be in love with someone, or should I be in love with someone to be in a committed relationship? Or can I be in a committed relationship and, you know, it works, we get along really well,
yeah,
we've been together 6 years, but am I in love with her? Well,
I think about this often, and I don't know what the answer is to that. If you look at, there's some studies of marital happiness comparing love marriages to arranged marriages, which might be a sort of similar situation. Over time, love marriage happiness goes down almost always. And some people, it doesn't go down a lot. But usually in the first year or two, it goes down a little bit. And that makes sense, you know, if you think about it, because in the beginning of a marriage, everything is so exciting and new. And of course, things will sort of settle down and become a bit more ordinary. In arranged marriages, happiness almost always goes up. Like, obviously, there are exceptions to this. But if you look at the graph, the two lines cross somewhere, you know, within the first 10 years. So it's possible, I think, to be happy and married to someone that you're not in love with. Is that what we want in North America? I say most people have a really hard time letting go of the myth of the one. You know, I think even if we accept that there's no such thing of the soul as a soulmate, which I think we should, by the way, a very anti-myth of the soulmate. But even if we accept that, I do think it's hard for us to let go of this very Western view of love and marriage.
So you believe in marriage, or do you believe in romance and relationships?
I don't know. What do you mean?
Well, do you have to and should you be married as the kind of culmination or the embodiment of one's romance?
Yeah.
Or desire? Or is marriage, and we go back to the conventional positions, that it's just a convention, it's something society expects, and if we're thinking of having a family, we should be married?
Right, right. Good question. I think I'm pro-marriage. I am. And there are lots of problems with marriage as a convention. If you look at the history of marriage, it's not... If you go way back in the long history of people getting married, you know, there's a very long, robust history of marriage that has nothing to do with romantic love. That comes in much later. So marriage has been used throughout history for a lot of political, economic, social reasons that have nothing to do with love. But I think the way we think about it now and the way we use it now when it comes to romantic love is kind of a good thing. It's kind of an asset, because being in a romantic relationship is at times a lot of work. And there's something, at least from my point of view, there's something really valuable about standing up in front of your peers, your family, your closest friends, and saying, we're committing to each other, and having these people hold you accountable to that commitment. And, you know, maybe there are other ways to make that commitment that aren't marriage, but marriage is the most obvious and accessible way to do it.
And it's a legal...
it's legally process. Binding.
Yeah,
yes,
it's legally
exactly.
Binding, so that, you know.
The flip side of that is that a lot of people who study romantic love from an evolutionary perspective would argue that we are naturally, as a species, monogamous, but serially monogamous. So that we aren't biologically designed to be with one person for our whole lives. So, you know, you could think about it either way. If you want to be with someone for your whole life, you want to really commit to them, I think marriage is the best way to do it. You need something that makes that will motivate you, some incentive to, like, double down on that investment.
And it formalizes the relationship or the arrangement in a way that takes it up a notch, I suppose. It does seem as though society still values the concept of love and marriage.
Of marriage. I mean, I think especially, like, I'm an American, so I've been watching all the political changes with legalizing gay marriage in the States right now, and it seems to be happening really quickly, and I think people are fighting really hard for that. Because marriage is, you know, there are a lot of things that come with marriage that are important, like the ability to make right decisions about your partner's health care and things like that. But I also think it's just a fundamental thing that feels very natural and human, and so we want this ability to make this legally binding commitment.
Okay, let's switch slightly to the blog.
Okay.
The Love Story Project. You've been doing this for almost 5 years.
I've been writing a book for about 5 years. I don't know how old my blog is. Maybe 3 or 4? Yeah.
What has the blog taught you?
Oh, I've learned a lot from the blog. It's been a really interesting experience. I mean, the biggest thing is, so I was writing this book, and the premise was, my parents were getting divorced, and I was really shocked. I didn't know that there was anything that wasn't working in their marriage, and I started thinking about why it was so difficult for me to process that. I mean, I think naturally it's going to be difficult for anyone, but I thought, I'm an adult, you know, I live far from home, why is this having such an impact on me? And my theory was that it came down at least partly to how invested I was in their love story. And so I started thinking about how love stories influence the way we think about love and our expectations for romantic love and our attitudes about it. And I started thinking, you know, maybe they don't do us much good. Maybe they don't make us much better at love. And maybe they make us a little bit worse. So we wanted to explore that. And what the blog has offered is just a kind of public way of doing what is otherwise a really private, lonely, solitary activity, which is writing a book. So I could think through ideas in that space. Because I post fairly regularly, my friends often talk to me about these ideas. I've had a lot of people ask me for relationship advice, which has been interesting. So it's been nice because it's just sort of generated conversations in my life that help me refine the ideas that I want to put in the book.
Did you grow up reading romance fiction?
No, I did not. But I did watch a lot of terrible romantic comedies as a teenager, as an adult too, probably. And fairy tales and, you know, I don't know, just the family histories. Like, I just loved love stories. And, you know, even if they weren't always in book form, I mean, we encounter love stories everywhere we look all the time. And I think they're really powerful. And not many people have written about how they work or how they influence us. So I thought, this is my topic.
This is what I want to do.
Yeah.
Now, so, but I'm getting the impression that an individual is divided between the myth and the reality. The myth is the romance. They're going to find that one person. And I know she is out there or he is out there. And it's just a matter of time.
Right.
And I will know it when I will discover that. But then there's the reality. You know, I'm 37 years old or I'm 51 years old and it hasn't happened. Oh, nevertheless, people still hope, don't they?
They do. They do. And what's interesting about this article I wrote for the New York Times is, so I've gotten tons of emails from total strangers, which has been a very interesting experience. And they've covered the gamut from asking for advice to just saying, hey, I liked it, to saying, you know, will you read a draft of my book and tell me if it's good? You know, it's very interesting. But a lot of people have just written to say, your article gave me a lot of hope, which I think was really interesting. It kind of surprised me. But then when I thought about it, I thought, you know, I guess that makes sense. Because when I originally read the study that Arthur Ahn did about making people, attempting to make people fall in love in the lab, it gave me some hope as well. I was going through a breakup at the time, so I thought, okay, it's possible. And I think the hopeful thing about it is that, like, a lot of people say things that drive me crazy, like, love will find you when you stop looking for it. I think that's a stupid thing to say. But that idea has a lot of currency, and so I think this is a sort of antidote to that idea, or a counter-argument, which is that you can find love, that you can actively seek it out, which maybe is the idea that makes people hopeful. There's something really demoralizing about feeling like, you know, I just got to sit here.
That exactly. takes us back to the beginning of our conversation where you said there have to be some fundamental elements of attraction initially. You just can't go up to someone who's also sitting alone at the cafe and having a cup of coffee and saying to this person, you look like you could be in love, and so I'm going to, you know, convince you.
I mean, I think attraction matters for sure. But I also think we if you compare the process of doing this study that Arthur Aaron has designed to make people fall in love to something like online dating, there's some interesting differences in those two processes. So I've done a lot of online dating. One of the things that I found is that people, and a lot of friends who've done this as well have said similar things. People go out on a date with a stranger and they make a snap judgment right away, like yes or no, this person is either attractive or not attractive. And it's very rare that people think, eh, maybe, like, let's give it another shot. And after doing all this research and reading all this stuff about love, my approach was always, you know, whenever possible to try and go on the second date, because I do think attraction is something that comes with familiarity and that comes with time, and that people become more attractive over time. And so as much as it does matter, there is a way in which when you get to know someone, you get to trust someone.
Do you find misrepresentation happening often with the online dating scene?
I've heard a lot of people claim that. I didn't really find that to be true at all. But maybe you have to get to know someone pretty well before you find that they have misrepresented themselves.
Okay, so we've been very kind towards love. But let's reverse it.
Okay.
Can I make myself fall out of love with someone?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. You know, there are things that you can do to facilitate it. I think if we could make ourselves fall out of love, we would all be a lot happier, because unrequited love is so painful. Or being stuck in a relationship that isn't healthy is so painful. I just read an article, I think it was on NPR, but they were talking about some research that shows that writing about a breakup speeds up emotional processing. So that might be one way to kind of reflect on it, get your emotions out, move on. You know, the advice that everyone gives, the advice my friends gave me when I went through a breakup that I did not want to listen to, was cold turkey, cut them off, get away from somebody. And actually, that's really great advice. The research that I've read that's really interesting shows that the brain of someone going through a breakup and the brain of someone going through cocaine withdrawal look the same to an fMRI scan. So both of those, being in love and using cocaine, generate this intense surges of dopamine in the brain. And when you are suddenly without someone, or when you're going through a withdrawal, you know, like literally your brain is craving that person. And so it's really difficult to just separate your lives. But I think if you can, you can fall out of love faster. Oh, but it's so hard. It really is.
It is. And of course, as you know, this was the very subject of this rather satirical piece that appeared in the New Yorker about your column.
Yes,
To fall out of love, do this. What did you think of that when you read it or someone pointed it out to you?
I was so excited. I was so excited to see my name in the New Yorker. But I thought it was great. The amazing thing about this, I've gotten a huge response from this New York Times column, just so much far beyond anything that I expected. But what seems to have happened now is this study, these 36 questions, have kind of taken on a life of their own. And it's, you know, beyond my article, it's now this kind of cultural phenomenon. It's really strange. And so there have been several satirical revisions of the questions. And I think when you write about something and popularize it to the point that it becomes a meme, you think, like, wow, I've really tapped into something that people are fascinated by. And, you know, who knew?
What's next?
So I think the next step is to put together a book. So I've got this blog, I've got a draft of a manuscript. Thanks to publishing this article, I now have a literary agent. So I'm working on another article that I hope will be out in the next few months on the neurochemistry of romantic love and how that relates to the metaphors we use to talk about love, which I think is a really interesting bridging of science and literature. And then hopefully to put together a book proposal. So I find one of the things about research on romantic love is that it's a relatively young field. It's really only been the past 2, maybe 3 decades that people have taken it seriously as a topic of scientific study. So there's just so much that's constantly coming out. Like someone asked me recently if I was getting bored talking about love, and I just thought, you know, I couldn't possibly. It's just this fresh, interesting topic. So the plan is to take all of these ideas about love and love stories, the rhetoric of love, our assumptions about love, and turn them into a collection of essays.
I really thank you for taking time to commit.
Thanks.
I know you've been very much in demand. So many thanks to Mandy, Katrin, whose blog is The Love Story Project, as we all look forward to further instruction, or at least direction, in love. And stay tuned for future profiles of fascinating figures from the Faculty of Arts at UBC. Thanks again, Mandy.
Yeah, thank you. I was really